You know, the way I looked at it is what something's worth is what people are willing to pay for it, kind of like the way Wall Street is. You know, it doesn't really so much matter what you paid for your stock. It's what somebody's willing to pay for it today. So what we did was kind of set up this dynamic auto-scaling pricing. So what happens is, you know, we don't go in and anymore and decide what the price of an item is, although 2 million plus customers and 88,000 unique visitors a day don't realize it. It's their activities on our site that set our pricing.
No kiddings.
You are listening to the Luminary Business Podcast, the podcast where passionate entrepreneurs and executives just like you discover how to become more prominent and influential and build a profitable business that truly matters. Join me, Todd Staples, as I unlock the foundational skills, habits, and mindset needed to produce optimal personal and business results.
So hello, everyone. Welcome to the Luminary Business Podcast. In today's call, I have the privilege of speaking with a new friend of mine, Rex McClanahan. Rex is the president of a company called Bud's Gun Shop, which is an e-commerce site that I stumbled upon when I was doing some research online. And these guys are not your average gun shop on the corner. We're going to dive in and learn a lot of history about the company, how they've grown to selling around 250,000 guns per year, almost 300 employees, and building a company that has incredible feedback. I was looking recently, there's A+ BBB rating, 28,000 reviews on reseller ratings of 9.3 or more, and a 99.8% positive feedback on eBay. So Rex, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you. And thank you for that very nice, flattering introduction there.
Yeah. I mean, you've really built something that is, I mean, at first glance, when I looked at the website, I was like, oh, these guys are really interesting. And when I used a couple tools to check out your traffic numbers and, you know, dig a little deeper, I was floored. So it was great to connect with you, and I'm excited to learn more about the evolution that you've been part of there and learn about some of your trials and tribulations and give some great actionable advice to our listeners who are either in a similar position or maybe where you might have been a few, you know, handful of years ago, to learn from what has worked for you and some advice you have.
Sure. Well, we'll do our best to make that happen.
All right. Fantastic. So let's start really just at the beginning. If you can tell us a little bit more than my intro, tell what the company does, a little bit about the changes that you've been part of for the past decade or so since you've been there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, BudsGunShop.com is the website that we're most nationally known by. We do have the Bud's Gun Shop retail operation as well, which started well over 40 years ago now with a gentleman named Bud Wells, the original owner and founder of Bud's Gun Shop. He was in that for all those years and then decided he wanted to try to take that gun retail business online. And he fired up BudsGunShop.com in 2002. It kind of floundered around for a few years, had an introduction with him, and he brought me in to be a part of that towards the end of 2005. And then we started making some moves. And then, of course, you know, you had the first election, Obama election, 2008, 2012, and that really drove the firearms industry pretty wild there for years. And so we went from not even a spot on the map to being the largest firearms internet retailer in the United States now.
That's great. You know, it's funny. You just reminded me of a funny stat I heard a long time ago about the largest arms dealer in the world was apparently the guy who invented the Super Soaker squirt gun. It's kind of a joke, but apparently they sold so many of those that he superseded any other gun dealer on the planet.
I think those are probably even legal in California.
Yes. Still, now they are. Could change. Well, that's really interesting. You know, before I dive any deeper, why did Bud bring you on? What was your skill set at the time and what were you doing? Why were you his right-hand man to bring in to get this job done?
Yeah, and he really, you know, I didn't know him. He didn't know me. It was a mutual friend of ours who was aware of and both of us and what we did and kind of saw the synergies, I guess. I was in aviation for 18 years. I went into business for myself when I was 19. Towards the end of those years, I was selling aircraft parts online as part of what I was doing in the aviation business and, was doing pretty well with that. And so this gentleman was actually a customer of mine and a customer of Bud's and knew Bud was struggling with his efforts to sell firearms online and knew I was having some success with what I was trying to do And so he introduced us at the end of 2005, and we actually sat on a picnic table at a little local restaurant here in Lexington, Kentucky, and had a long neck beer or two and shook hands, and I became the manager of his internet operation.
That's great. So it was a napkin agreement, huh?
Yeah, we didn't even write on napkin. We just shook hands. If you know Bud, that won't surprise you. He's a pretty much shake hands contract kind of guy.
It sounds like the type of thing you would do if your name's Bud. Bud and Rex sounds like a handshake kind of team there. That's great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
when you first backed, and that was in what year was that, Rex?
That was in 2005. The website first went online in 2002. So I came in towards the end of 2005. You know, I said I started with Bud in 2005, and we had a one-year handshake deal. Well, it was going so well about 8 or 9 months into the deal, he was really nervous about me leaving. And after I finished my 1 year, with the handshake, and I told him, Bud, I'm good. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm not going anywhere. And so he wanted to make me a partner in the business. But at the time, the business was the internet and the retail stores and everything was one business, and he owned it. And I said, I really don't want any part of these gun shows and the retail store and all. And I've been in business myself all these years in aviation. I really like working for somebody else. It's something I didn't get a big chance to do, going to business for myself at 19. And so he kept pushing for it and I kept pushing back. I didn't want to do that. And so this went on for a while. He really hit me and wanted me to make me a partner. This went on for a few months. Well, I was back in the office one day, sitting at my desk, much like I am now. And, back then they had the old Cisco phones and he would beep something. They'd come, hey, Rex, can you come up here to my office for a second?
Yep.
Sure, Bud. So I walk out of the back and then because where our internet department was and through the retail store where all the customers saying we're up into Bud's office. And I walk into his office, which I've been into many times before. And there's a fellow standing behind him in a suit. I didn't know who this guy was, but I walk in and Bud looks at me and said, I've got you an offer you can't refuse.
In no way.
And I said, you watch me. And that's exactly what I said. I said, you watch me, because I was set. I was not going to be back into another business. You know what I mean? Or into that. I still had my aviation business. I had not ever sold my aviation business at that time. And so the guy behind him in the suit was an attorney. And so what they had done was created this new entity called BudsGunShop.com LLC.
Yeah.
And this was in the end of 2006, a year after I started. So as January 1, 2007, they had this entity starting up called BudsGunShop.com LLC. He had taken all of the things that I liked doing, the internet part, and created a new company and took all the stuff I didn't want out. Okay. And he said, so here's this new company I've created, BudsGunShop.com LLC. I'm 50%, I'm 100% owner right now, but I'm selling you 50% for a dollar. And he reaches his pocket and he goes, and here's the dollar. And so
that's awesome, Rex. I love that story.
I took the dollar and I gave it back to him and I said, you're right. That's an offer I can't refuse. And that's
wow,
how I
that, came to looking back on that. Is that the best dollar you ever spent or what?
Oh my gosh.
a few million times over, I'm imagining.
I just told people I wish I wouldn't have handed it back to him. I wish I'd have gave him a different dollar and kept that. Because I'm sure he took it back and bought a cup of coffee or something, but I would love to have that dollar.
Frame now. That sucker. Yeah, the ROI on that, I can't even imagine. What a great story. Yeah. That's really fantastic. Yeah. So that's really nice of him to take the time to do something that you had requested, I just love some of the history in the company, how you have treated your staff and how you've built this company and how it stemmed from Bud too. That's a really neat story.
Well, good. I'm glad you like it. It's kind of fun to recount some of those things. I don't think about them all the time until I sit down and kind of in a situation like this and need to, but they bring back some good memories.
Yeah, that's great. It's a great story. All right. So since it's kind of a controversial topic and a, industry, especially right now with another election year, what was it like back then in terms of the legality of selling guns online? And actually, can you just explain that for the listener? Because when I came across the site, my first thought was, what? I was shocked. I couldn't even believe you could buy a gun online. So now I understand how the process works, but can you explain that so people listening understand?
Sure, I would be glad to. I probably need to evidently explain it to our attorney general and some other folks because the things you see in the press makes you wonder what they know about it. But no, it's very simple, actually. I mean, even if you take it back to the folks that buy guns in their local gun stores, and we do have, you know, local gun stores. We have three stores in Kentucky and Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And so when somebody would go in to buy a gun from one of their local stores, you know, that gun came from somewhere. You know, it came from a distributor, it came from a manufacturer, it came from wherever. And so they would, you know, go pick out their firearm, and in the process of purchasing their firearm, you know, one of the things they do is pay for it. And the other thing they do is they take possession of it via Form 4473, which are your firearms, federal form, your background check, if you want to call it the NICS check. And so that's the way most people are, you know, if they're not, you know, aware of buying guns online, that's the way that they're used to doing that. So the only difference in what we do is that you kind of split that transaction up. So on one, you go on our website, you find the gun you want, you pay for the gun, you make the financial transaction. Then we send it into your local dealer, and then you go there and pick it up, and that's where you do the Form 4473 and all that. There's no financial transaction there other than if the dealer is charging you for the service of the transfer itself, but not for the firearm. So it's, as far as legalities, you know, the firearm is always going to, well, say on a new firearm, not on a used one, but a new firearm, it's going to go from the manufacturer to the distributor, to the dealer like us, and then on to another dealer. And so, and eventually end up in the hands of a consumer. So it's all being documented from FFL to FFL. And I don't want to say abbreviations and assume people know Federal Firearms Dealer. Yeah. Federal Firearms License Dealer, until it ends up into the hands of an end user on a Form 4473, which is the federal form under which you take possession of a firearm. So, yeah, you're not circumventing anything by buying a gun online. You're just kind of putting the transaction up a little bit.
Sort of like if you go online and you get your groceries and you pay for them and then you pick them up at the store and they're all ready to go.
Absolutely. Exactly. Except maybe your milk doesn't go bang.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, I mean, that makes a lot of sense because, again, like when I first saw it, and I'm sure a lot of people listening and seeing the title of the podcast episode are going to think, what? How is that possible? They imagine you go online, you buy a gun, and you just ship it to your door, and it circumvents all the issues you just talked about. So that's good clarity. Are you the one responsible for dealing with the form and the background check, or is that the shop, or what did you call the location where they pick it up?
Yeah, the FFL dealer or their local gun dealer, if you will. Yeah, they have to. You know, we can't do that online because of the way that which goes down. That person's got to be physically present with a photo ID and fill that out. So that's not something we can do online. And so that's always done at the point where the buyer goes in to take possession of the firearm from the dealer. So, you know, again, if we've got a person, let's just go back to California, and they buy a gun from us. They tell us which dealer in their area they want us to send it to. We ship it out there. That dealer then takes it into their possession, and then the customer can go in and pick it up from that dealer. Again, not much, you know, no different than if that dealer would have got the gun from the manufacturer or another distributor. They just happen to be getting it from us. We're just it's kind of like a different supplier.
Got it. What's the benefit of the store, the shop, actually doing that transaction? Do they get a commission on it? Do they get a piece, or do they just get the customer in their door so they can then upsell them other products?
Yeah, yes, to all the above. And really, that's it. I think we've got over 50-some thousand FFL dealers nationwide that we've shipped to. And we had to start with number one back in the day, but we've got a tremendous number of them. Both a lot of them are, you know, individuals that do the service. Some of them are actually, you know, gun stores, pawn shops, everything. Anybody can have a federal firearms license dealer. License can do the transfer. But yeah, the folks that have the stores, you know, you think about, in our case, we're always spending thousands upon thousands of dollars to advertise to get people to come, whether it's to our website or to our store, and we're not guaranteed that they'll show up at all or if they'll buy anything, right?
Yep.
In this case, we're sending a firearm into your establishment if you're the dealer, and this customer is going to come in, may or may not be a regular customer of yours, and they're going to give you money one way or another. Even if all they do is pick up their gun and leave, they're going to pay you for the transfer. So you're going to get that money. But the other kind of a, you know, residual effect of that is you have this opportunity to meet a prospective new customer. People that buy firearms, usually they want ammunition for it. They want a holster for it. You know, they might want some training. If you've got a range, they'll shoot your range. So those dealers really try to use that opportunity to cultivate a long-term relationship with that customer.
Very cool. So let's go back to the time when you guys started the business, you ramped up, you started the online store. What did that look like for the next few years after you joined in 2005?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I was just sitting here looking at some numbers. It was kind of amazing. You know, our growth was, as I'm looking here, 209%, 388%, 144%. That was in the first 3 years. And so it was pretty crazy. You know, it was a lot of fun. It was very challenging. Growth is challenging. You know, the numbers look good, but there's a lot of support behind the numbers that's necessary, you know, especially when it comes to customer service and shipping and accounting and things like that. So it was fun, but it was also, you know, also a struggle at the same time.
So you must have gone really, I mean, really quickly in those initial years from 7 to 8 figures, I'm guessing. And then hockey stick. Well, I don't know if things plateaued off to the point you're at now, but I'd love to hear sort of the differences in your day-to-day activities and focus and challenges from when you went through those different evolutions from like 7 to 8 figures and 8 to 9. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And, you know, going back to when I first got there, I BudsGunShop.com was, basically the gun store was previously a bowling alley, and BudsGunShop.com that Bud had kind of spun off to do this was what used to be one of the women's restrooms in the bowling alley. So it was me and three other people working in a room that had a drain in the middle of the floor and pipes sticking out of the wall. And that was BudsGunShop.com in 2005. And so, which was cool because I got to learn, you know, everything, you know, from the customer service to the accounting to the shipping. You know, it wasn't, you could not turn your head and learn all that because it was all going on in the room and around you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as things began to grow, you know, physically we had to, you know, move into larger offices. We had to hire more people. Pretty soon, you know, it wasn't too long after that we realized that we were going to have to, not just continue that, but also to pick up some contract folks, you know, to help us with that growth. So we kind of had to look outside of our own facilities and our own staffing and get some, you know, we started working with obviously staffing companies, fulfillment houses.
Yeah, what were you hiring for mostly during those initial stages of, you know, 200%, 300%, 200% per year growth? Was that mostly logistics people? Was it customer support? Who were you finding you needed in those early stages?
It was then and it is now. It's constantly customer support. You know, basically okay. Now I think I was looking the other day, we're up to a little over 88,000 unique visitors a day to the site. That's a lot of people that have a lot of questions or a lot of issues, and they do not like to wait, you know, to have those questions answered. So, we went from, you know, in the early days, we did that in-house, and then we contracted that out for several years. We didn't go outside the U.S. The call center we had was down in Destin, Florida. And then we got to the point where we kind of outgrew that, so we were big enough to start bringing things back in-house. And so now, you know, all of our call centers and our shipping and everything, we now took back and took control of, which I like. There was a period of time there it just wasn't financially or realistically, you know, we weren't capable of doing it. Just with the growth that was going on, we needed to contract and get some help in. But once we got things, you know, kind of through that, we started bringing things back in house. And so, which I much prefer, you know, I don't have any, didn't have any really bad experience with contracting things out, but you do lose an element of control.
Yep.
Not that I'm a control freak, but I just like to make sure those things are working and that represent us well.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to do that if you're managing a team that's not even under your same roof.
Absolutely.
And if it's a call center, you're not even really managing them, are you? When you use the call center, how much training were you even responsible for giving them? Or were they literally just answering phones to take orders?
Yeah. And that's the one thing, you know, we didn't want to go outside the U.S. and not to say that, you know, there might be some really great examples. We didn't have any opportunities there that we were comfortable with at the time in our particular industry, firearms, or maybe some great examples of that in other industries. We ran into this one down in Destin, Florida, and we were, we had multiple people that we were sending to Destin to train with those folks all the time. We probably kept one or two people down there probably 6 months out of the year, just making sure, you know, they were not only, you know, being trained, but that the answers they were giving and the things they were doing were in line with what we would have liked to do if we could have done it ourselves in-house back then.
Yep. Got it. And as you as you've been there through this like big change and big growth spurts, what were something that really stands out as one of your biggest pivotal moments, like the biggest success? I mean, there must have been a few moments where you tried something new, you added new inventory, you started using photos or videos. Was there anything in particular that was like a major contributor to the growth?
Yeah, you know, there's been several things and that's, you know, it's not been any one thing in particular that's responsible for all of it. There are several things that really helped our efforts along the way. I think if I had to pick one in particular, I would say it was the way that we price, you know, we got 120 some thousand different SKUs on the website, firearms and accessories and ammo and all in. And, you know, if things get more competitive as other people started joining the internet retail market, which is, as you know, happened a lot over the years.
Yep.
And what you kind of find is that there is no one margin fits all and not just for every SKU on the website, but even just take a particular firearm, for example. Let's just say Smith & Wesson, which most people know Smith & Wesson. Well, Smith & Wesson, like any other manufacturer, they have some products that perform exceedingly well and some products that don't perform so well. So to go in and say, well, I'm going to make 10% on all Smith & Wesson firearms is really not, I don't know, it's just not the way to go about things. You know, the way I looked at it is what something's worth is what people are willing to pay for it, kind of like the way Wall Street is. You know, it doesn't really so much matter what you paid for your stock. It's what somebody's willing to pay for it today.
Absolutely.
And so what we did was kind of set up this dynamic auto-scaling pricing. So what happens is, you know, we don't go in and anymore and decide what the price of an item is, although 2 million plus customers and 88,000 unique visitors a day don't realize it. It's their activities on our site that set our pricing. If something's
no kidding.
Not selling.
So is it actually, it by purchase behavior or by browsing behavior?
It's all of it. It's basically an algorithm we wrote ourselves years ago. I sat down, kind of like you talking about the napkin thing earlier.
Yep.
Me and an IT guy at a Mexican restaurant. And I said, look, this, you know, we got to change this. And at the first thing, it was just kind of like an idea. But then we kept talking about it and made it work. It's not like we took a napkin back to the office to reprogram. It took a course of probably about a year. But we just took all things in, you know, basically we get a lot of data, you know, we're looking at all this stuff that's going, we see all these people come to the site, we see what they're looking at and buying, we see what they're looking at and not buying. If they're buying it, how many are they buying per hour, per day, per 30, 60, 90 days? At what time of the year are they buying it? Because a lot of firearms are seasonal due to hunting seasons. We're looking at what's the supply chain look like? You know, how many more can we get of these if we run out of them? All these things go into an algorithm that then price each individual of those 120 some thousand plus SKUs based on all that that's going on. And it updates about every 20 minutes. So it's pretty live. It's pretty
that's current. Incredible.
Yeah. So for example, you know, it might be that we have a left-handed Savage with a thumbhole stock, there's something weird it doesn't sell a lot of, it might be at a single digit margin because that's what it's going to take for somebody to buy one of those. And then if we have a, you know, a very popular firearm that people are buying at such a rate, we can't even get that many from Savage, for example, we need to go up on the margin of those or we're just going to be out of business on those very quickly.
Wow,
so
does it also do anything in terms of like your competition, the competitive pricing? Or is it all internal based on your site and your visitors' behavior?
We do have the ability to look at some competitor prices. I got all these things now, the bots, the scrapers, the compilers, and we look at that. You know, we look at it. We don't actually include it in our algorithm. We do look at it because what we do is get a report that if there's any discrepancies that are, whether it be low or high, it's a way to flag us that, hey, maybe there's a problem here. You know, like all of a sudden, you know, if you're losing 15% on something, you know, we compared to it'll send us an automated email to just prompt us to look at it. Or if it says, you know, we're making 50% on something, which would be ridiculous in our business, it causes us to go in and take a look at it and see maybe somebody miscued on typing in a cost or something like that. So
got it. Yeah, that's really neat. Have you done, you know, one of the things that I've found in my, when I had an e-commerce business, I sold it a few years ago, but when I do e-commerce consulting, one of the things that I find always turns up some really great insight is doing an 80-20 analysis of products either by revenue or by profitability. Have you done anything like that? Is that like in terms of, you know, I don't know if you've seen that sheet. I'll put it in the show notes for anyone listening, but it's basically you go into your analytics, Google Analytics, you export all your product sales, and you can make a VLOOKUP table to look that up based on your cost of the product if you have that too. And basically it'll rank your products. It'll show you, you know, your top products in a way that shows you how much of your total sales or your total profit are coming from your top selling items, right? And when you go through that, you know, the 80-20 theory, Pareto principle, states that generally speaking, 80% of your profit will come from 20% of your items. So, or 80% of your profit.
That's very true in our business. Probably less than 20% actually, but that's very true, you know, in our business. Yeah. And I know your viewers probably can't, you know, are not looking at the website, but in that same kind of respect, you know, and again, giving credit to our customers and our traffic for dictating our prices and other things. The very first thing you see if you go to the homepage of our website is a section called Hot Selling Items. It's at the top of our site. And yep. What people don't know, unless they listen to this podcast, what they don't know, and for many years, I changed this years ago. It used to be that on the front page, it had something called weekly specials, and our people would basically put up, you know, what was special. And now you'll see that, but it'll be lower on the page. And so that's our in-house folks deciding what's special this week. And, you know, that's kind of very opinionated. Everybody's got their favorites. Even our own staff does. That's not really what I want to do. So hot selling items, if you look at that, top to bottom, left to right, is the top selling firearm, because that's what we sell those, top to bottom, left to right, in order of what the customers are buying. And we, you know, it's automated. We don't touch that either, like the pricing. So yep. When people look at that section, and I have a lot of folks that I've talked to that are investor type folks. And if you look at that page after any type of a high profile media event, you will see it change relatively quickly.
Oh, wow. So you mean if something comes out about a specific handgun or rifle, like that'll actually shift positions into the top left of your hot sellers?
Within a matter of hours. Like, for example, the last one I was talking about today, the unfortunate shooting in Orlando. And so when there's a shooting like that and they start talking about the needing gun control on certain types of rifles, you will see that whole page be nothing but those type of rifles, which is reflecting the fact that that's what everybody's buying. Because if you start talking about controlling
scarcity,
anything,
right?
Yeah. Then that's what folks buy. Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the key elements of persuasion and conversion on websites is scarcity. So yeah, if they're hearing that in the media that this is no longer going to be available or potentially no longer going to be available, I can see how that can skyrocket sales for those items for sure.
We've actually got some grief from that in the past where, you know, when I first set that up years ago, it's just like, let's just show them, you know, the customers are coming to the site, what everybody else in the, you know, United States, these hundreds of thousands of customers every day think is, you know, the hot selling items. You know, let's let the purchases of all these folks dictate what's on the website in that order. And so that was all I was thinking about. I didn't have any other, you know, motivations or agendas behind it. Well, inevitably what happens is something like a shooting, whether it be San Bernardino last November, Orlando here back in June. And when that happens, you will then see, like I said, you know, that be populated by a certain type of firearm that's kind of high profile in the media and stuff right then. Well, then I'll usually get some people that are really upset with me or upset with us about advertising all those types of guns right after one of those events. What they don't realize is
it's dynamic.
I could take them off. You know, I could go in and interrupt that automated feature for a temporary time, but what they're seeing is the reaction of the nation, not BudsGunshop.com or Rex McClanahan.
Wow. So, you know, you've probably grown a lot as a person going through this evolution of the company too. So what are some of the things you've learned maybe about your own management style or growing a business? Because I assume when you were selling airline or plane parts online, you weren't managing a team of 300 people and had a lot of different things you were focused on when you were a solo business or a small business. What have you learned as the company's grown to the number of people you have now?
Yeah, it's a very good point. You know, with aviation, even probably, you know, I started out with just myself, and after 18 years, I probably had less than 10. So it is very different. And what I realized that if you, in this business, that if you want to grow, you're going to have to, delegate, authority, delegate the, the work there is to be done. And, you really have to invest in people. It's so easy just to tell people the answers or do it for them because it's so much quicker for you yourself to do. And a lot of times, when you're growing as fast as we are, you're always pressed for time, but you really got to make yourself take the time to explain what you're doing to folks, your staff, the thought processes behind whatever it is you're doing, why you think that way, and really invest in them, which is painful at times. You got to have patience. It takes money, but the return on investment of investing in your employees is much greater. I can say now after several years and 300 employees, much greater than the investment we made in any firearms or ammunition or real estate or anything else we've done. Had I not done that, and I say myself, and it just kind of trickles down, I started sharing my thought process and the way I want to do things with a few people around me. And then they had staffs under them and so now it's kind of networked its way out like that. But had I never done that, it would have been impossible to grow and be where we are today.
Yeah, I think that delegation, the step from keeping ownership of everything you do because you might do it best or have always done it that way, and kind of evolving into someone who focuses on training and delegation is what I've seen be a game changer for a lot of people. And I know someone from our previous conversation, Rex, as you talked to me about this, which really like got me excited when I heard this, about your philosophy about being in the office and how you have put some conditions in place to encourage people to learn on their own. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, both in my aviation business, I said I was in it 18 years. Last 4 or 5 years, I worked from home. This firearms business now probably worked from home for, probably another 4 or 5 years. I've been on with it 11. So, I worked there in both situations and which I think is important to know what's going on, at one point I knew every aspect of the business, whether it was customer service, accounting, shipping, marketing, whatever. And then, and I think it's important that you do at least delve into each of the pieces of business, so that you understand what's going on in your business and you're not just having people tell you that you have to accept as the truth. you have a lack of knowledge yourself. So I don't think that's good, but what it got to be for me, and I'm the guilty party. I always wanted to answer the question for people. I always wanted to do it for them. And I called it like the Hey Rex syndrome. Like people would go by my door every day, Hey Rex. And I would be their crutch. I would give them a quick answer, or I would walk out and do it for them or whatever. And I realized that was not helping me at all, for sure. I'd be there at 5 o'clock, and as everybody was leaving, my day began because everything I wanted to do didn't get done due to that Hey Rex syndrome. So I came back home like I had in my aviation business and, allowed those people to figure things out. They really needed me. They still could get a hold of me. It just wasn't as easy as Hey Rex. They had to pick up a phone and call me, or they had to email me.
Yep.
I made sure that when I was either talking to them or send them an email, I made them kind of respond to me, whether it was for their benefit or mine. I wanted to know that they truly understood what it was. The answer that I talked about, it wasn't an answer yes or no, but do you understand the thought process behind why I told you yes or no?
I want to go a little deeper there. So the premise of this show, generally speaking, is to find these relatively small things that you might do and you've adapted them over years that you almost forget. They're just so second nature to you, but make a big difference. And I think what you're saying right there really does have an impact. So can you maybe walk us through a real specific example of an email correspondence that follows that strategy?
Sure. A lot of it's customer service. We get customers that will make requests of us that fall outside of our policies. We don't have a written policies like everybody else. In the past, if somebody came in and said, "Hey, Mr. So-and-so wants to," it might be some outlandish request. And what do you want us to do? I'm like, "No, we can't do that." And they go back and tell them that and go away. But, you know, the issue is there's all different types of situations and different types of customers, and you need to be able to analyze that based on every situation, because another customer might come in with a request that falls outside of our policies, but, you know, the request is reasonable, even though it's outside of our policies, and this has been a good customer. You know, you look at his history, I mean, where, and you need to make, you know, a good decision for us and the customer. You know, you don't just make a decision based on the policy. Well, that's, you know, that's just what it is, and that's it. You know, if I was a good customer somewhere, and maybe I even made a mistake. I said, look, I really messed up. I ordered the wrong thing here. I don't know what I did. I got in a hurry. I'm sorry. It's really not what I want. Can I return it and get something else? Well, normally that's going to come with restocking charges and freight, because we got a substantial cost in getting that out to you, right? For the most part, we could, by policy, you know, deny your request to do that and charge you the return freight, the shipping, full price for the other gun, whatever. But if you're a customer who's been with us for years and you've bought several things from us, you know, I think there's some grace that should be, you know, allowed for those situations. So you can't have a customer service person get hold of you and say, you know, what's the answer? Yes or no. It's really not a yes or no answer. It's,
and
you know,
more than that, you can't have them getting in touch with you every time something comes up, right? They need to be able to make that decision.
Right. Yes, exactly. And, you know, and the thing I say is, let's just say maybe it's whether or not they do that or they don't, or sometimes they'll give customers a gift card when they mess up so that they've got, you know, a $10 or $15 or $20 credit towards a future purchase, those types of things. And so it's not that, and I don't sit here and assume that of all the, we got two shifts in a call center, three stories tall, that goes on from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. There's no way that every time that happens throughout the day, if somebody's issuing a gift card as a customer PR type motion, whatever, that it's the exact amount of money that I would have done if I took the call. You know, that's not the point. It's just that, you know, that all in, you know, everybody in that building all day is making good enough decisions for us to make our customers happy, from like the numbers you reported there when you did the introduction, and for the company to be profitable, you know, and for the company to be profitable. So, you know, it's it doesn't have to be my answer.
So
exactly.
Do you give your staff sort of guidelines and then they can make their own decisions? Like, I know some people will issue a sort of an allowance where you can spend or lose up to $50 per customer without asking. Do you have any kind of set rules like that so they can make most of those decisions without having to pass it up to someone higher up the chain?
Yeah, what we do basically, in a way, I mean, it's not for every, you know, like I said, the number of people we have in the call center now, they don't all have that flexibility to make those decisions themselves. There's team leaders and call certain, you know, managers there that have to approve, you know, if it's over a certain amount, or whether it's a, you know, a gift card for future purchase, or if it's a return or something, or an exchange, something like that. Then they're going to have to defer that. And I don't mean they just put the customer on hold, or just whether it's an email or live chat, they can, you know, ask that question right away and get an answer from them. They don't have to come to me, you know, but they're going to go to one of their team leads or the customer service manager, depending on the significance of the issue, and get it done.
Yep. Well, Ben, it must be pretty interesting working with that volume of people. I mean, that's a lot of people on staff. And the other dynamic is being at home. So how often are you in the office?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a going joke around there. every once in a while I get called to go out to sign something, or, you know, go to a meeting or whatever. And it is a gun store, so people aren't allowed behind the counter. And, you know, I don't dress a lot like a businessman. Probably I'm usually in the summertime, I'm in khaki shorts and tennis shoes and a t-shirt.
Yep.
And so, I'll go out to sign whatever they need to sign or do whatever. And I'll go into the store and I'll go to walk behind the counter to go to the back where accounting is. And they'll be like, sir, you know, they really don't even know who I am. So,
That's funny.
A lot of cases, they haven't been there very long. Now there's people that's been out there longer than I have. You know, there's people that work for Bud before we got into the internet business, where I came in. So there's folks, several folks that work for me now that have been with Bud, the entity, longer than I've been around. But
no kidding.
Yeah. Newer folks, sometimes will stop me at the door.
Yep. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm really fascinated by the fact that you've chosen to change things up and work at home, because there's probably a lot of people listening who make the assumption that once you get a business to a certain size, like, oh, then it has to be a corporate business because, you know, once you're doing 8 or 9 figures, then you have to go in every day and you have to run it like a real company. And I love the fact that you're challenging those assumptions and actually doing it for a reason, right? Because those got a minute Rex meetings were just eating up your day. So I can imagine that you get a lot more done not being there. And then get more time with your family. You have 2 kids, right?
Yeah, actually, they just got home from school. I hear them coming in the house in there. But yeah, and the other thing, you know, it's not just something that I believe is true for myself. You know, obviously, there's a lot of different tasks that go on that are different. You know, the warehouse, retail store, accounting. That it really isn't reasonable for people to work from home in those situations. But just for example, our main buyer, who is you know, he's got a lot on his plate because he's the main buyer for all 3 retail stores in the internet. He's got buyers under him. But they wanted to, him and his wife really were wanting to live in a home on a lake. And that was going to cause him about 3 hours of driving every day. And I talked to my partner and I said, you know, why is he coming in? You know, he doesn't interact with anybody. All of his buying is online and over the phone, and you have internet and phone in his house. Why is he doing this? You know, he's buying, you know, everything we sell pretty much, you know, goes through his buying, you know, or either him or his staff. So, you know, he's doing a lot. And so, yeah, we're like, yeah. So we told him to go ahead and work from home. He started probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago. And I was with him the other day. We were flying somewhere and I just talked to him about how easy he, you know, how it was going. He talked about how much he loved it. And, you know, obviously that, you know, the time he was in the car and the fuel and just all these other things, his quality of life is so much better. And he said, you know, he used to leave the office at 5 with a lot of things not finished. You know, he basically would try to get everything that had to be done that day and then decide what could be left over till the next day and go home. He said, now at 3:30, he goes, I'm done with everything. Like, I'm finished.
Yeah.
You know, he still goes on and does stuff. But he's like, it's just amazing. And that's what I have found. You know, I went from my days were impossible to, you know, being manageable. Yeah.
That's great. That's fantastic. So in terms of your day working at home, do you have certain habits, maybe daily, you know, either daily habits or just kind of general tendencies that you have that you think have had the biggest success or biggest impact on your own personal success, Rex?
Wow. Daily things. Probably pretty boring to most of your listeners, really. You know, I'm just kind of a average guy. You know, I do try to I get up in the morning and get my cup of coffee and sit at the computer and try to take care of put any fires out if there are any. I'm thankful to say there's not too many these days. And then I try to go in the mornings when I go to the gym and try to get the both physically and mentally, you know, get that kind of release because it gets pretty intense around here at times. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm no good to anybody if I'm not healthy, my family or the company. So I try to make that a priority.
And were you always like that? Did you always prioritize fitness? Because I talked to a lot of people who seem to, you know, when they were starting out and really struggling and maybe running a smaller business, they seem to work, you know, overwork and under exercise. And then as they sort of figured themselves out, they started taking more time to be balanced. And it actually counterintuitively, when you take time off of work to enjoy life and exercise, it seems to make you a lot more productive and get more done.
Oh, 100%. And my thing, you know, I was one of those people that just came to this lately. You know, I'm 48 years old now, and a lot of that stuff I was doing, both in the aviation and early part of the guns, had its toll on my health. You know, I'd get high blood pressure and things like that, and I really never was a lot overweight, but my cholesterol was going up and stuff, and I got on medications for all that. And now I've been off of that medication totally for years, you know, after I started working out. And what I did, you know, it was funny. I don't know how many gym memberships I had in different places that we lived and things. Mm-hmm. And I never went. I would go, my wife's, you know, she's an avid workout person. She's there every day, if not twice a day. I went to get the membership and then I never went back. So she was, you know, getting concerned about my health and stuff too. And so she went in and she was, you know, you need a personal trainer.
Yep.
Okay. So I went and got a personal trainer. And what that is for me now, it's an appointment. When I talk to people and they say, hey, you know, can I meet with you tomorrow morning? I said, I've already got a meeting. I've already got an appointment. I never even talk about going to the gym, but I treat it just as important, if not more so, than any other meeting I have. And I treat it like a meeting. You know, it's not optional. I'm there. You know, I'm there on time. I'm there to get stuff done. And that's made all of the difference in the world for me, because when I looked at it as going to the gym, you know, for me and being optional, and I could go anytime, I'd always start off my day by, like, with the intent of going later, and later never happened because your day would get away from you. But, you know, that's something that I've been doing for probably like the last 4 years, and it's paid huge dividends. And some of the, you know, coolest ideas that I've come up with in regards to our business have happened when I'm, you know, on the track or working out, when I'm not intentionally thinking about work.
Yeah, that's incredible. One of the last questions, well, the last question I was going to ask is if you could give the listener one thing to do, one piece of advice that you feel would have the biggest impact on their success in their life. I'm kind of feeling that might be your answer. Is that right?
Well, you know, it's definitely one of them. I think the thing is that, you know, success is a word that gets thrown around a lot to me. And talk to people, they'll ask me about success or being successful. And, you know, you think of all the listeners you have, and it means something different to a lot of them. I mean, you know, it depends on what your definition of success is. It probably, if I gave you a piece of advice on what I thought was most important to be a success, that would be related to my definition of success, you know, not theirs. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the best advice I could give is that you really want to put a lot of thought and effort into defining what your success is. Don't just say, I want to be successful, or I wish I was successful, or whatever like that, and not really know what it means. Because, you know, if you really truly understand what your personal definition of success is, then like most things in life, if you understand it, you can do it.
Yeah, that clarity really helps move you forward, because you know what's at the finish line, right? You know exactly where you're going. Yeah. But I think you're right. When people just say, I want to be successful, it's like, what does that mean? Does that mean you make X amount of dollars? If that's so, how many dollars? By what date?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And some people, you know, it has got nothing to do with finance. Other people's definition of success has got nothing to do with numbers. You know,
it might be working 2 days instead of five and traveling the world. Yeah, but defining that, I think, it's very smart. Well, I'm just about to wrap up. You know, one more thing I just want to ask before we do, because sometimes when you hear about a company like yours, it's gone from a handshake in a little corner store to a $100 million plus company. It seems like you were just had this charmed life and everything worked great. Can you talk a little bit about some of the mistakes or challenges that you had and what you would have done differently if you could go back?
In this gun business in particular?
Yeah.
I was really challenged early on. You know, I grew up in Kentucky and, you know, was a farm boy and more of a common sense guy. You know, I didn't really excel in school. I was a BC student, dropped out of college to go into business when I was 19. The thing was, I'm kind of an old school guy, you know, in my aviation business, I interacted with all my customers face to face. And in those 18 years, I really never had any escalated issues with any customers and all that. And I get into the internet, and pretty quickly I realized that when people are sitting behind computers all over the nation, the types of things that they say are very different than what people say when they're standing within arm's length of you. And I took it very personal. You know, I wanted to lash back out at them. There's probably things all over the internet from those years ago where I would basically tell people they were lying or whatever. And, you know, I had never really been exposed to that type of interaction with not just customers, but people, you know, the type of nasty things that they would say. And you know, you're sitting here knowing not only that what they're saying is not truthful, but you're knowing that a lot of people are reading this and they don't know it's not truthful. They might actually believe this about you or about your company. And I get really upset about it. And, you know, I finally, there's just no way to win that. You know, I tried and I lost. And so finally I just resolved myself to that, you know, the people that really know me, really know our company, our people, they know what we're about, who we are. They're not going to believe that stuff about us, no matter how much of it is out there. And there's a lot of it. And I learned to be okay with that. And, in the beginning, I did a really poor job of that.
Yeah, that's a hard lesson to learn. I went through that too when I started selling online, because you are spot on. And for people listening, if you've never dealt with online sales and you're new to this game, just brace yourself, because when people are chatting with your staff or they're writing your emails, they can be nasty. I mean, and then you, I had a local shop in Los Angeles, so we would meet, we would discuss via email or text or chat with someone, and they would just be, I mean, ruthless.
Oh, yeah.
And then sometimes they would come in person, you meet them, and it's like a completely different person. So I really understand what you're saying there. And that is a good lesson to learn. And especially now with social media, you got to be real careful how you respond to people. The tactic I just adapted was basically kill them with kindness, you know, every chance you get, no matter how furious they are, just try to keep a smile on. And it's a good test of patience and will if you can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And I probably don't even go that far with the kill with kindness. The two things I did was, one, get myself out of the customer service department.
Smart. Yep.
But a lot of people between me and a lot of that stuff. And then I usually just don't respond, respond at all. But we have even stuff where people send us emails, that are really just, say, if you don't send me a new, I've had this more than once. If you do not send me this new firearm in particular, which one they want, then I'm going to spend, I'm out of work and I'm just going to spend the whole next week copying, pasting stuff all over these sites.
Yeah. Awesome.
And there's really nothing that, I guess there might be something you do, but I'd rather spend my effort somewhere else. But we get those types of things. And it is, because you could write one really nasty, article about somebody and copy and paste it all over in a very short period of time.
Sure. And that stuff can rise to the top the way that Google works. They like to show the good, the bad, and the ugly on that front page search results. So whether it's true or not, sometimes it shows up. Well, Rex, this has been really fantastic. Thanks for dropping all these great nuggets of insight. It was fascinating to hear about, the story of you guys starting the business on a handshake, building this fast, seeing massive growth from just a few people, a Bud's Gun Shop down there in Kentucky, to, a very big online business, doing nine figures, employing close to 300 people and getting 88,000 hits a day. I mean, it's really impressive what you've done there. And I love just some of the things that you went through that you learned, setting up an algorithm to present the products that people are really interested in, price things in a way that's good for the customer and good for you. Learning to delegate and investing in your people, I think, is a critical skill that people listening should very much pay attention to, because that can be a game changer when you're growing a business and scaling up.
You're definitely not going to work at home like I am if you don't do that.
True. I mean, you got to learn to delegate and give that responsibility off and give people the opportunity to have some responsibility and become leaders within your organization, I think, is really important. And then keep an eye out for giving people those opportunity to work at home. I think that's not typical of a company of your size. And, it's possible. So just because you're big doesn't mean you have to be rigid in your structure. If you think that works and your employees like it, do it. And then last, just the advice on, your fitness and your health and focusing on that and making that an appointment. Like, it is just as important or more than any appointment you have during your day. So I love that you have that great insight there. Rex, thanks for joining us. This was really great. And I will put a bunch of links to the site, to anything else you want to add there. I'll put it in the show notes. So if you're listening, you want more info on Bud's Gun Shop or Rex or anything else we talked about, just go to luminarybusiness.com, find this episode, and everything will be there in the show notes. Thanks for coming, Rex.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate the opportunity, buddy.
All right. Have a great one.
Thank you for listening today. Before you go, I want to leave you with three important questions designed to get you results from what you just heard. Number one, what one lesson did you just learn that you can take action on? Two, what single action can you commit to doing in the next 24 hours to integrate this skill, habit, or mindset into your daily life? And three, what can you do to ensure you will actually take this action? Speed of implementation is the key to success, and you've got to take action on what you just learned. Perhaps you need to put a reminder in your calendar, put a post-it on your computer screen, or talk to an accountability partner to check in to make sure you did this. whatever you do, make sure you take action on the one key thing you learned from this episode to make sure you start seeing results. You deserve the success and peace of mind that comes from building a profitable and influential business that truly matters. You deserve it, your family deserves it, the world deserves the best business, products, and services you have to offer. The thing is, sometimes it's hard to take action on your own, which is exactly why we've created the Luminary Business Community at luminarybusiness.com. If you want to be part of this thriving community of entrepreneurs and executives committed to building profitable and influential businesses, head over there and sign up for our waiting list. As a member, you will get training, checklists, cheat sheets to grow your business fast. You'll get access to exclusive in-person events and meetups. You'll get expert coaching from me and other experts in the group and feedback when you need it most. Fourth, you'll have access to a supportive community of like-minded entrepreneurs. Finally, if you liked what you heard on the show, please subscribe to the podcast, write a review on iTunes, or share a link to this episode with one of your friends. It will help them learn and will also spark conversations that could potentially lead to new business for you, which is what this entire show is about. Thanks for listening and make it a great one.